On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we have Mr. Curtis Franklin, Mr. Brian Chi here today. Have you ever noticed that companies sometimes hide information from search engines? Well, they bury it deep on their site. Well, what if I told you that healthcare has started doing this? Would you start not trusting them? We'll talk about it. AI and ML is revolutionizing businesses, but it can take specialists to ensure that organizations get it right. Well, this week we have lead data scientist from Data IQ, Trivini Gandhi. She's going to take us through how organizations can reduce that barrier and ensure that you can take advantage of it. Shouldn't miss it. Twi on the set.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Twiit, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 438, recorded April 9th, 2021. AI ethics and biases. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Technology Powers X. Learn how technology is reshaping business through an original podcast from Dell Technologies. Search for Technology Powers X anywhere you listen to podcasts and download each episode today. And by the Enterprise Tech 30. The Enterprise Tech 30 is a definitive list of the 30 most promising B2B startups as determined by over 100 venture capitalists and 20 corporate development teams. Visit EnterpriseTech30.com to see 2021's winners. Welcome to Twiit, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresca, your guide through this big, giant world of the enterprise. But I definitely can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the professionals, the experts in their fields, starting with our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. He's a senior analyst at Omdia. Curtis, it's been a busy week for you in the Sunshine State. What have you been up to?
It has been a busy week. Been doing things like getting some reports published, working on some articles that are going to run at Dark Reading, and beginning to think about what we're going to be talking about at Black Hat. You know, registration for Black Hat USA opened this week, and it's going to be a hybrid event, which means there is going to be an in-person component. And after a year of sitting in my office, I can't wait.
I'm looking forward to all that material. Thanks for being here, Curtis. Well, also speaking of busy, we have Mr. Brian Chi, net architect at Sky Fiber. Chibert, you have some good news for us. That's right.
Yeah, I got to sign away a lot of money today, and I am no longer homeless. Woohoo!
Woohoo! When do you actually get to physically move in? When are you guys going to move in?
There's going to be some construction that has to be done. We've got some drywall work that needs to be done. We've got some locks, a few things here and there. We're going to move around some of the large built-ins. But for the most part, we have the keys. And tomorrow, I think, I'm going to change the locks.
Well, speaking of busy, it's been quite the week in the enterprise news space. Have you ever noticed that companies sometimes hide information from search engines? Well, it's a common technique, and healthcare is starting to use it. We'll talk about it. Plus, AI and ML are revolutionizing businesses, but it can take a specialist to ensure that companies can take advantage of it. We have lead data scientist from Data IQ, Trivini Gandhi. She's going to take us through reducing that barrier of entry and ensuring that your organization can take advantage of ML and AI. But first, before we get into all that, let's go ahead and this week's news blips. Now, remote work has become the norm for many, and you may even be using some online collaboration tools like Slack and Discord. Well, what if I told you that these tools are now the center of focus and attacks by hackers? You probably won't even be a little bit surprised there. Well, according to a new report, Slack and Discord are being hijacked by hackers to distribute malware. A new report from Cisco's Telos cybersecurity team found hackers found a newfound love for content delivery networks, CDNs. Now, the same methods which have many instant messaging platforms use to actually allow seamless file sharing are the very heart of criminals' newfound love for these chat apps. Now, the collab tools come with a few perks designed to actually make communication more seamless, right? Well, cyber criminals can leverage features like that to efficiently distribute malware and ransomware as well. Besides distribution, they're also using these platforms for command and control and exfiltrating sensitive data from victims. Now, when it comes to data exfiltration, the Discord API, for example, has proven to be quite an effective tool. In fact, as the webhook functionality, originally intended to actually send automated alerts, was designed to send out any type of information, malware frequently use it to make sure stolen data reach their intended destination. They also use webhooks to notify of newly infected systems as well. Now, this means that if you continue to use these tools to make remote work bearable, you should make sure you also pay close attention to the apps you're installing on these platforms, even if they give you some fancy emojis.
Well, we'll file this under because we didn't have enough to worry about. Voice changing software has been found on APT Group's attack servers. The discovery of voice-changing software on the server of APT C23 could have implications for the group's future phishing attacks, according to Cato security researchers. APT C23, a group connected to attacks in the Middle East, is known as part of a larger group called Mole Rats that is mostly located in Palestine, the report states. Mole Rats usually targets political parties in Palestine and the Israeli government, specifically the Israeli Defense Force, or IDF. On occasion, though, the attackers have also been known to target Western governments. Cato Security calls APT C23 a, quote, medium sophistication, end quote, group, and notes it typically relies on social engineering to manipulate victims into downloading malware. In the past, the group has been known to impersonate women to trick their targets into installing malicious applications with the ultimate goal of espionage. Now, with all of that as prelude, one of the tools found on the APT C23 server was voice-changing application called MorphVox Pro, which included a serial key and voices pack. Given APT C23's previous phishing campaigns, researchers speculate the group is using this tool to produce audio messages that could be used to convince targets to install malware. And we know from experience that if a technique works for one APT group, it won't be long before we see it used by others.
Well, this story from Ars Technica talks about the Supreme Court has sided with Google in its decade-long legal battle with Oracle over the copyright status of application programming interfaces. The ruling means that Google will not owe Oracle billions of dollars in damages. It also has big implications for the broader software industry, since a ruling in the opposite direction could have triggered a wave of lawsuits against software companies that re-implemented other companies' APIs. Well, the case dates back to the creation of the Android platform in the mid-2000s. Google decided to base Android on Sun's Java programming language, enabling existing Java programmers to easily develop for the platform. Google independently implemented the Java API methods, but to ensure compatibility, it copied Java's method names, argument types, and the class and package hierarchy. Well, a few years later, Oracle acquired Sun, and soon afterwards sued Google, arguing that Google's copying had infringed Sun's copyrights. Over a decade of litigation, Google won twice at the trial court level, but each time the ruling was overruled by the Federal Circuit Appeals Court. Well, this case finally reached the Supreme Court last year. Well, I'm going to agree with the Supreme Court, and my two cents worth is that we actually do need some consistency with APIs, or software complexity will continue to spiral out of control. Commonality could also potentially create more source code review situations, which in my opinion may actually help cut down on things like Trojanware.
Now, we were hoping botnets were a thing of the past, but hackers still find ways to actually hide them in plain sight. Now, a newly discovered crypto mining worm is stepping up its first target of Windows and Linux devices with a batch of new exploits and capabilities. Now, research company Juniper started monitoring what is called the SysRev botnet in December. Now, one of the botnet's malware components was a worm that spread from one vulnerable device to another without requiring any user action. Now, it did this by scanning the internet for vulnerable devices and, when found, infecting them using a list of exploits. Now, the malware was also included a crypto miner that uses infected devices to create the Monero digital currency. Now, SysRep developers had redesigned the malware to actually combine the worm and the miner into a single binary. Now, they also gave the malware loading scripts to the ability to actually add SSH keys. Now, having these keys means that they can actually survive reboots and have more sophisticated capabilities. Now, the worm was exploiting six vulnerabilities in software and frameworks used in enterprise software, including Mongo Express, XSL Job, XML RPC, SaltStack, ThinkIt PHP, and Drupal Ajax. Now, the actual botnet binary is a 64-bit Go binary that's packed with the open source UPX executable packer. Now, there are versions for both Windows and Linux running here. Two Windows binaries chosen at the random were detected by 33 and 48 of the top 70 malware protection services, according to VirusTotal. Now, two randomly picked Linux binaries had 6 and 9. Now, this botnet threat isn't just the strain on computer resources and the non-trivial drain of electricity. Malware that can run CryptoMiner also almost certainly can also install random ransomware and other malicious wares. As we always say, stay vigilant. Keep your devices up to date, because you never know, one day your device just might be infamous as part of a botnet attack.
Well, Zoom joined Microsoft Teams on a list of enterprise tools hacked at this week's Pwn to Own. A pair of security researchers at the virtual Pwn to Own hacking contest on Wednesday exploited a combination of three individual zero-day bugs in the Zoom client to show how attackers could gain complete remote control of any PC or notebook computer on which the video communication software is installed. The exploit came barely a day after another researcher at Pwn to Own demonstrated code execution on Microsoft Teams, which, like Zoom, has seen a surge in use since the global COVID-19 pandemic forced an increase in remote work at many organizations. The Zoom exploit garnered security researchers Dan Kuiper and Thijs Alkermaet of Dutch firm Computest Security an award of $200,000 and 20 so-called Master of Pwn points. Their exploit involved chaining together three bugs in the Zoom Messenger client to gain code execution on a target system without the user having to click or do anything. Independent security researcher OV demonstrated code execution on Microsoft Teams by combining a pair of bugs and was paid $200,000 for the effort. These exploits were just two of several high-profile exploits at the Pwn to Own event, where some $1.5 million was up for grabs to security researchers who could find and demonstrate exploitable vulnerabilities in a selected list of products across seven categories. Microsoft Teams and Zoom are now nearly ubiquitous, and so far, there hasn't been a lot of research done on their security. With events like Pwn to Own raising that visibility, the interest could change very, very quickly.
In the next few months, SpaceX could have more than 1,600 of its Starlink satellites in low Earth orbit, and that may be enough for the nascent broadband service to reach just about anywhere in the world. Quote, after 28 launches, we'll have continuous coverage throughout the globe, unquote, SpaceX President Gwynne Shotwell said this last Tuesday during an online panel discussion for the Satellite 2021 LEO Digital Forum. The 23rd operational Starlink launch was set for this last Wednesday. That means we're about a half a dozen launches away from the point Shotwell describes. SpaceX has already successfully conducted seven dedicated Starlink launches in 2021 so far, quote, along with 10 more of the satellites on the Transporter 1 rideshare. Well, considering the constant buzz about price increases with Comcast, Spectrum, and Cox, it's no wonder consumers are constantly looking for an alternative. Well, now that you can sign up for Starlink outside of the beta program, there is a lot of buzz about service speeds stabilizing. I begin to wonder if it would be better to think about Starlink instead of Spectrum for my new home. What will be interesting is how Dish is now pushing the FCC to modify the operating license for Starlink due to their, quote, proof of interference with their communication system. Ought to be interesting to see how many millions will be spent on this court battle.
Now, Google Play has been notorious for distributing apps and tools that could be nefarious in nature. Well, a new variant of Android malware has been discovered in an app on Google Play that entices users by promising free Netflix subscriptions. I don't know about you, but that sounds good to me. Now, Checkpoint Research CPR said that the wormable mobile malware was discovered in the Google Play Store, and on the malicious software dubbed Flix Online disguises itself as a legitimate Netflix application and appears to focus on targeting the WhatsApp messaging application. Now, with the pandemic still in full swing, people are home binging on their favorite shows and movies. I know I am. Now, since Netflix subscription fees are on the rise, anything free, people will definitely jump on. Now, the fraudulent app promised global unlimited entertainment and 2 months of premium Netflix subscription for free due to the pandemic. Now, once downloaded, however, the malware listens in on WhatsApp conversations and auto-responds to incoming messages with malicious content. Now, upon installation, the app asks for overlay permissions, a common ingredient in the theft of service credentials, and battery optimization ignore, which stops the device from automatically closing down the software to save power. Now, also, Flix Online requests notification permissions that give the malware access to notifications related to WhatsApp communication and the ability to dismiss or reply messages as well. Now, approximately 500 victims were claimed by Flix Online before detection, now, over roughly 2 month period, and the malware will likely appear again in a different form. Now, CPR informed Google of its findings, and the app has been now removed from the Play Store. However, the damage might have already been done here. Now, if you know, for yourself, if you have this app on your device, back up your data, wipe it clean, doing a full reset. Now, because you never know that, you know, there could be some residual software on their services lurking on that device in the long run. Take care of it. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But before we get to the bites, we have to thank a really great sponsor of this week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Technology Powers X, original podcast by Dell Technologies. Now, each episode of Technology Powers X focuses on a different industry and goes behind the scenes to help you understand how technology is reshaping business everywhere. Now, I got a sneak peek of Technology Powers X. In fact, supposedly you're like me and you're a roller coaster buff, and how the technology powers the best rides of your life. Well, you need to check out episode 2, where Danielle Applestone talks about how today's roller coasters are powered by complex algorithms, and they capture real-time data and in fact even provide predictive maintenance. Pretty interesting, right? Well, every episode of Technology Powers X is captivating and exciting, so definitely check it out. Now, our recent episode features researchers who are studying the architecture of the human brain in an effort to develop more versatile AI models. Another episode explores the world of professional esports, featuring a behind-the-scenes look at Team Liquid. And one episode talks about vertical farming and how innovative new tech can change where our food comes from and how this may be the future of sustainability and feeding for 21st century populations. If you're a pet lover, check out episode 14, The Best Partner for Pets. Here's a clip.
Yet today, technology plays a growing role, not just in happy reunions, but as an invaluable tool to America's animal welfare workers.
Search for Technology Powers X anywhere you listen to podcasts and download each episode today. That's Technology Powers X. Download it today. And my thanks to Technology Powers X for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for the bites. Now, it's a common business technique sometimes for businesses to hide information from their customers, right? Well, sometimes they actually hide it from search engines as well. And a lot of companies like Comcast are actually notorious for doing this. Well, hospitals used to be part of the camp as well until federal rules requires them to make a change here. However, hospitals that have published their previously confidential prices to comply with the new federal law have also blocked that information from web searches. They did this by particularly coding an embedded code on their site. Now, you may be wondering, why are they doing that? Well, the code that actually keeps pages from appearing in searches such as those related to hospital names and prices. Now, the prices are often accessible in other ways, such as through clicks or links in the page and going through multiple layers in the site. Now, the Wall Street Journal examined more than 3,100 hospital websites, finding that hundreds of them use the code that actually hides their price lists from Google and other search engines. And that's not to say that there's also information that was disappeared from the web ultimately, like not even showing up anywhere. It could show up other places if there's some screen scrapers or some other data pullers, but users could still eventually find it by clicking on other multiple pages within that site. Now, the investigation found that some of the regional hospital systems used this code on their websites, as did some of the biggest U.S. like HCA Healthcare and NYU Langone Health as well. Now, I want to bring my co-host in because this is an interesting topic. Obviously, a lot of organizations, they put out proprietary data about themselves, whether it's the features that they offer, the pricings that they offer, the data, the devices and services they offer, and they want that to stay on their site. I want to throw it to you first, Curtis. What do you think? Is it is something that you think is nefarious, or do you think it's they're trying to do it in a way to help their customers?
Well, I do think it's nefarious. I don't think it's intended to help their customers at all. There are a lot of healthcare organizations who really depend on no one thinking about the cost until after services have been rendered, if you have the situation that so many people find them in, where you have one individual receiving the service while another organization, the insurer, pays for the bulk of the service, it can slide by unnoticed. And let's face it, these things tend to happen when people are least likely to be concerned primarily about cost. They're concerned mainly about getting well. At a deeper point, though, it does raise an interesting question about an organization's right to control how their information is spread. Previously, organizations would control that by whether or not they published in book form or made you go to the office to pick it up. Now, we tend to assume that if something is published to the web, that it is going to be crawlable, indexable, available on Google and Bing and all of the other indexing engines. But is that a requirement? Because when a company does make their site crawlable, it allows some other organization to decide how their information will be available. This is one where it's very easy to have a knee-jerk reaction, and I did. But then I started thinking about it, and for many of our listeners, the question is, does your organization have the right to control its message, or have we entered an era of radical transparency where being open with just about every bit of information is not just expected, but is mandated?
I do. I get that point of view, Curtis, actually. I do get it that, some organizations, they want their data to stay in the format and the form that they are presenting it in. And in fact, this is a defense of a lot of the hospitals out there. In fact, they're saying that they just don't want people finding raw pricing, on these search engines. Like a lot of search engines like Google, Bing, DuckDuckGo, they actually will go and produce a list of metadata, whether it's pricing or show times or whatever, and they put it in their own format. And so the question is, does the hospitals really want that format? Also, do they really want comparisons too? Like a lot of times these types of applications and search engines will produce comparison matrix as well. And that's not conducive to necessarily to good healthcare in that sense. So that's their defense. Jupiter, I want to throw it to you. Is it a valuable defense? Do you think that makes sense? Or are they really just trying to hide stuff?
I'm going to put this into the same category as you can make statistics say whatever you want it to. And I think this is going to be the same kind of issue. The reality is there's an awful lot of hiding in healthcare. I just learned about a friend that's been denied a kidney transplant for very, very long time. And the bottom line is the hospitals didn't want to take a higher risk transplant because they didn't want to ruin their perfect record. while this doesn't sound like the same thing, it kind of is. You know, you're trying to protect the golden goose. Let's call it the golden goose. And maybe, just maybe, there's a few things that they make a lot of money on, and then a few other things on that price list that they don't make as much. And what they really don't want is, they don't want to have like a Google search engine where you can go shopping and shop for a even cosmetic. You know, if I wanted to go and get rid of some moles, as a consumer, I think that would be a great thing. But from a hospital point of view, they would hate it. Now, I'm not going to say this is a good thing or a bad thing, but I will say to the U.S. medical industry, your prices are way, way out of line. And maybe, just maybe, instead of complaining about consumers shopping, maybe you guys need to sit down with the insurance companies and the legal beagles and fix the root problem. But I'm just sitting on a soapbox bitching about the cost of medical care.
Indeed. Yeah, I think one last question to you, Cheaper. I want to throw it back to you one more time before we go on to the next one. You know, obviously organizations can make a choice here, right? Google gives them this option to provide the ability to ignore sites and not produce, you know, their marketing and their data anywhere. You know, is this something that should be regulated? Is it something like we should come along and say, you know what, this particular type of organization is too important. We shouldn't allow you to hide your information, especially from search engines where people use that to find data nowadays. Does that make sense?
It makes total sense. And, you know, I have been a recipient of socialized medicine when I was doing some things. And it was darn good medicine. You know, I was treated well. It got done. And even though I was a foreigner working for, you know, Her Majesty's government at that time, it was great. It was cheap. And I asked the person behind the desk, goes, why is this so different in pricing between the United States and the UK? And she said, well, obviously I don't know, but I gotta imagine a lot of it has to do with your stupid lawyers. And it's like, okay, lawyers, it's all fine and good to protect the consumer, but have you made your bed into some of the most expensive healthcare on earth? And yeah, maybe it is time for some regulation, because self-regulation doesn't seem to be working. And when a person gets catastrophically sick and basically has to mortgage their house in order to pay the hospital bill, something is broke. So, yeah, I think I'm way the heck off the original topic, but I think it's part of a systemic problem that we need to fix in America, and the legal world needs to back off and work with the medical industry to try and find a middle ground. But soapbox done.
Well, thank you, Cheebert. I agree. I think things definitely need to change. Well, folks, that does it for the Bites. Next up, we have our guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Wrap. But before we get to that, we do have to thank another great sponsor of this week in Enterprise Tech, and that's the Enterprise Tech 30. The Enterprise Tech 30 is a significant research developed by Wing Venture Capital in partnership with NASDAQ. Now, the private enterprise tech is an opaque sector. You have no idea which company is going well or doing well or poorly due to caginess around growth and revenue, especially as sales cycles can be long and arduous. Now, there are many ranked lists out there that feature startups or tech disruptors, but these lists are often dominated by consumer brands or more mature B2B startups everyone already knows. Now, these lists create credibility and trust that a company featured will deliver a real tangible outcome. However, this is often not the case, as the way many of these lists are produced is by lobbying or pay-to-play methods and are subject to bias based on how much hype a company can generate. Now, the Enterprise Tech 30 brings to light the enterprise startups who have the most potential to tectonically shift how enterprises operate for the better. Now, awardees to the ET30 are on the fast track of growth to change how business is done, and are expected to be future IPOs and multi-billion dollar exits. Now, it's not possible to lobby your way onto the ET30. In fact, you can only be selected and become part of the elite community. The Enterprise Tech 30 focuses on companies with potential at all stages of maturity, rather than only showcasing companies with mature businesses and undeniable traction. Now, the ET30 can be considered a buying guide for enterprise executives seeking to bring more validated and credible digital innovation into their organizations. Now, enterprise tech founders should see inclusion as the highest endorsement of their current and future success. Founders that aspire to build publicly traded companies should see inclusion as a watershed moment in their founders' journey. Now, tech executives and high performance operators will use the list to help guide their decisions on what companies to join. Now, the 2021 edition of the Enterprise Tech 30, brought to you by Wing Venture Capital and NASDAQ, just launched. Head over to EnterpriseTech30.com to see who made this year's list. That's EnterpriseTech30.com. And we thank ET30, Wing, and the NASDAQ for their support of this week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's my favorite part of the show. We actually get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. Today we have lead data scientist at Data IQ, Triveni Gandhi. Welcome to the show, Triveni.
Hi, thanks for having me, guys.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, we here on Twilight, we love to start the show with our guests with a little journey through tech and maybe an origin story. Can you maybe take us a little journey through tech and what brought you to Data IQ?
Yeah, so I like the term origin story because it makes me think I'm a Marvel superhero. So I will gladly exactly. accept that question. My origin story. Wow, it's a wild one. So I did a PhD in political science and finished that in 2016, 2017. And thought, this is not going to ever change anything. So I need to get out of this and go and be impactful somewhere. So I ended up doing a bit of a stint in a couple different places, but worked for 2 years as a data analyst at a nonprofit dedicated to education data pipelines in the New York City area. Fantastic organization, does a lot of really great work. But you know, I wanted to do even more. So after teaching myself more Python, more machine learning, all of that fun stuff, transitioned to this role at Data IQ. And I came on about just over 2 years ago as a data scientist and have recently moved into this senior data scientist role with a focus on life sciences and responsible AI.
Fantastic, fantastic. Now, you know, obviously we've had a lot of people on. We talked a lot about ML and we talked a lot about artificial intelligence. Obviously there's separation of those two things. Can you maybe just give a definition of what you think machine learning, deep learning, and artificial intelligence is, so we can have a little bit of a discussion about like what people think about it, what actually could be different between those?
Yeah, so I think that you know we like to conflate all of those terms, but machine learning really is about using data to find patterns, understand those patterns, and then be able to take an action based on some pattern, right? But then you have the deep learning side, which is much more in the neural network space, much more about creating sort of black box models that may not really make sense to an outside observer, but certainly can perform a really important task. And then, you know, the AI space, I would say, is sort of a giant overarching term for all of that. And I know that our CEO has a really nice matrix of this that he wrote in a Medium article. So I can share that with you guys later to share with our viewers, but it's a really interesting sort of calculus of how much is your machine learning application, AI application doing, and how much is it like, what's the scale of it to then figure out, is it ML? Is it AI? What is it?
Right. Now, you know, obviously, machine learning, artificial intelligence, one of those things that a lot of organizations actually have to go and hire data scientists or engineers to be able to build some of these things. And I see a lot of what Data IQ is doing is essentially trying to democratize AI and ML to help organizations deal with their data streams. Can you maybe tell us a little bit about what you guys are doing and how you're making it easier for organizations?
Yeah, so you got it right on the head, right? Democratizing AI for everyone. So the idea is that there are people who know a lot about their specific industry, about the business, about the underlying, you know, value that they need to get out of their data and information, but they haven't done 6 years of, you know, coding or a PhD in computer science, and they're not going to. We shouldn't lose that amazing, rich information they have just because there's some sort of great push towards, oh, everything should be highly technical now. So Data IQ comes in and helps bridge the gap between folks with really good, deep industry knowledge, but maybe less technical skills, and bridge them with the people who have technical skills and the background in machine learning and engineering to then work together. You know, so it's not only democratizing it and making it easy for people who are, you know, we call them coders and clickers, but also breaking down sort of those silos and really being collaborative, which is really cool to see.
Right, right. So the interesting thing, I started reading a lot of the new term. Obviously, there's a lot of ops terms today, DevOps, so on. And I started reading a little about the MLOps. Can you maybe take us through? You talked a little about collaboration, obviously. MLOps, it sounds like it could be some collaboration between the average person in a company and the ML, like data scientists. Well, what does that mean? How does it kind of set that up for an organization?
Yeah, so, well, MLOps, when you think about MLOps, right? That's a part of the model deployment and productionalization process that, you know, a dev team or an ops team would be focused on. But what's nice about the sort of new push towards MLOps, or at least the collaborative push, is that now folks who build a model, or at least are going to be using a model once it's in production, you know, they can work directly with those DevOps teams and say, hey, it looks like there's something off with what's going on here. Can we confirm that our model hasn't drifted, right? You know, is the underlying data that we use to train this model still actually aligned with what the model, you know, what the new data is coming in? And so being able to actually ping people, pick up on signals earlier and then self-correct is one of these big benefits of the new MLOps space.
Got it. So yeah, I think that the interesting thing is I've noticed a lot of organizations, they have lots and lots of data. They don't know what to do with it. They don't have experts to do it. What some of the tools that you're providing, are they, what kind of a persona are they targeting? Are they targeting the finance gal from, you know, finance department? Are they targeting like an engineer at the company or IT person? Where do we start, and where do organizations start with this? And then where can they go with it?
Yeah. Well, we have something for everybody. Right. From the business user who just needs a good report at the end of the day, to the analyst, to the data scientist and engineers who want to get in there with Keras and TensorFlow and all those fun things. And then even C-suite folk are using Data IQ to help understand their data and actually make better decisions based on that. So I've seen, you know, entry points at all levels of that, where it's just, you know, the right, like, I love these images of people. You know, you've got the head of analytics, you've got the CDOs, you've got analysts and data scientists on board. And I've seen our users really grow from, you know, small teams to enterprise, like, you know, entire enterprise wide organizations. And what's nice is that as these teams start producing value from their data that they hadn't unlocked before, other teams see that and say, hey, we want that thing too, because that's going to help us accelerate ourselves. So it's, I don't know, it's just, it's great. It's really, it's a wonderful tool for anyone in that sort of persona, of any persona who is going to be tangential to data.
Right, right. One interesting thing I'm noticing is that, you know, you have the the kind of person who's not really techie, they know they have a lot of data. They kind of funnel this in. They work it through some models. And I see this on a lot of services and systems that organizations start to use, is what comes out the other side is something, you know, that they go, okay, well, the model looks correct. That data looks correct. But then how do they really know it's correct? Well, especially if they don't have specialists or they don't have, you know, they don't have, you know, data scientists on their team to help them understand that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's where having your business, you know, industry specialist is so critical. And that's why, you know, we hear a lot about, oh, AI is going to take away all of our jobs and, you know, the robots are coming and whatever. And I don't buy that because you still need, you know, a human in the loop. You still need someone who can come in and say, no, that's absolutely just off. Right. And when I started my job as a data analyst previously, you know, I came in and I started doing work and saying, oh, okay, I built at the table as needed. And my boss could look at it and in 5 seconds be like, no, you're missing all of these things because she knows her domain. She knows what's needed. So if you don't have that domain knowledge person with you, it can actually be really tough to figure out if you got it on the nose or not. And you might just be shooting in the dark.
Right. Well, I do want to bring my co-host back in. I'm going to throw it to Curtis first, because Curtis, I want to get your enterprise view of this, because obviously a lot of organizations need AI. They need machine learning to help them to make decisions and help their organization. You know, throw it to you.
Well, I absolutely do have some questions, and I think it's important because we know that AI, machine learning, can help us automate processes and get to results faster than ever before, but it's critical not to get to the wrong answer faster than before. So I know that model bias, where the data used to train the model is biased by the data scientist, by the inadvertent prejudice of the organization itself, any number of reasons, is a critical issue. But in your work with companies, how receptive do you find them to be towards a critique using that term? Bias is one of those words that is very charged. Do you find that companies resist being told that they have model bias or data bias being used in their models?
You know, I think more and more we're seeing companies are not resisting it in a, oh, don't tell us what to do way, but it is really about saying, okay, we understand that there are risks to what we're doing. And since this is a bit of the Wild West out here, we need to make sure that we're above board. Now, is that purely from a beautifully like articulated value standpoint of we care about the world and we don't want to hurt anyone? Probably not always. I think it's a little bit more of the stick to say that, ooh, did you see those guys and how they ended up in the news? And we do not want to be that. So we need to figure this out. And so I think when you come to a company and you say, look, there's some biases here and that presents real risks to you, they immediately are like, yeah, no, you're right. We need to work on this. In my personal view, of course, I would want everyone to say, yeah, we shouldn't be biased because that's a bad thing to be. But I also know that, you know, pigs aren't going to fly anytime soon.
Well, I think it's fascinating because, you know, perhaps an artificially intelligent pig could figure out how to fly. We'll leave that for another conversation. But, you know, one of the other things that I'm really interested in is when I talk to companies that are using machine intelligence of some sort, trying to find out if what they're really interested in doing is improving the speed at which they reach a particular known set of conclusions, or they're looking for the system to help them make correlations that they could not make without the help of the intelligence system. Do you see a breakdown in how companies are making use of the machine intelligence and whether there's a difference in the impact of model bias on either one of these sides?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think both of those things are really important to a company. And as much as I hate this answer, it depends on how much they are going towards one side or the other. When I think about organizations or clients I've worked with that have a lot of different sort of analytics that need to get sent out to multitudes of people, they're really looking to take what they already know needs to be done and quickly scale it, quickly use, you know, a product like our own to rapidly get that information in a automated and clean pipeline so that it can keep getting out to the people it needs to get out to. But then once those things have been squared away, they can sort of return back and go into the exploratory phase, look for new correlations, look for new associations, and start interrogating what they have been doing and say, did we actually miss something here? Let's go back and review. Let's make sure our data's were in the way and shape that it should be and doesn't have sort of biases in it. Are our models fair? Is the model drifting once it's in production? And these are the kinds of things that you can start focusing on once you've, you know, settled that first layer of just getting the data and information out to the right people.
Well, that's awesome. You know, I like that attitude. But there's an issue that got brought up in a report from 2014 from the Obama administration. Is called Big Data, Seizing Opportunities and Preserving Values. The Executive Office of President Obama pointed out the fact that, quote, big data technologies can cause societal harms beyond damages to privacy, such as discrimination against individuals and groups. This is one of those flags that I've been waving for quite a long time. It's back to the old garbage in, garbage out. I'm actually thinking this might be a good segue to go and talk about the article that you did in a blog about the three big biases in AI. And maybe you'd like to soapbox on that a little bit.
Soapbox is like my dream come true. And you guys have viewers, and I guess theoretically you can mute me, but I can go on for a while. So be careful what you wish for. Ask for Brian. I think the thing that's really important to me about all of these considerations, and so, you know, the world out there has these terms, responsible AI, ethical AI, transparent AI. And what does all of this mean? I think when I look at it as a data scientist, as someone working in a software company that works with enterprise data, this is one part of a much bigger problem. So my colleague, Alexander Lando, wrote this great piece on different biases within our data sets, right? But just knowing that there's going to be those biases is not enough to actually do something about, is not enough to say that, okay, we've covered our bases, right? Responsible AI, when you think about it, is wrapped up with MLOps, is wrapped up with governance. And these are questions about systems. Right. We want to build a product. Okay. Let's start at the beginning. Does this product even need to exist? Who might be harmed by this product? What are the potential unintended consequences? These are the kind of questions that enterprises need to be asking up front. And then once they've vetted those things, come to the table, come to the machine learning pipeline and focus on these things like bias and fairness. Which our tool helps them with, but you know, we cannot do everything for you. Those questions, those bigger sort of conundrums, those have to be handled by the organization themselves to say, what are we okay with and what are we not okay with? And now that we know that, let's use our tools appropriately to stay aligned to our intentions. And so in all the debate around responsible AI, ethics, transparency, I like to think about it as intentional AI. Are you doing what you think you're doing with your AI? And if you aren't, own it or fix it.
Nice. I like that. Yeah, because I did some work with a blood analysis laboratory, and that's when I learned some of the dirty secrets behind the curtain about how there's too much data. So you assign models to things with bias. You know, so if there is a name that is very clearly Oriental, you're going to put an Oriental template on it. Same thing for African American and so forth and so on. There are biases in a lot of data anyway. How do we unbias? How do we go and make sure we put things in perspective? And that's one of the things that this is where I think we need some sort of I don't even like the word consensus. I think it's time that we start getting data scientists together and start talking about the what if scenarios, because we've got some serious what ifs that could blow up in our face if we're not too careful. And I'd hate to see government regulation. I think this is something that we need to do as an industry. And I'd like to toss that to you and say, hey, should we be getting together and talking about things, especially once this stupid pandemic is done and we can meet face to face again?
Joke's on you. I'm never leaving my house. I do think that there is already a sense of consensus building happening among researchers and scientists and ethicists, I think that's the term, as well as numerous people in this space who are coming together, both in, abroad. I've seen stuff like this happening all over Europe. Singapore has similar consortiums. We've got things in the US like the Partnership for AI and numerous sort of independent research groups that are working on figuring out, okay, what are the guardrails? How do we self-regulate? Or if the government wants to regulate, how can they do it in a way that's both good for everyone? That's good for everyone. And you mentioned that, data scientists and all of this, we need to come together and we need to discuss that. I don't think it's just the data scientists, right? Because the data scientist is only going to see so much of the work, right? Who's in charge? Who's doing the governance of these ML projects, right? Who's in charge of the ops on these projects? Who's in charge of the design of these things? And who's the overseer? So you can't put the burden only on the data scientist. That also has to sit within every layer of the organization in order for it to actually have any value. One thing I will say, though, if I may speak directly to my fellow data scientists, is that there are numerous resources out there on how to understand bias in data and models, as well as the ethics of AI. And I think that what I like to frame it as is that you have to understand that you're starting from a place where everything is biased, right? No data set that you get is going to be free from bias. Everything is informed by historic context. So knowing that, what can we do differently, or what can we look out for as we're building our products to make sure that we're accounting for that? And the term debiasing data, it's not possible, right? You're not going to debias data. What you're going to do is introduce a different kind of bias that's meant to correct for what's there, right? Or saying that we want to see the world look like this. And so this is why we're going to, manipulate our data or sort of massage it to create the view of the world that we want to see, and then build from that.
So I want to throw a quick question in there a scenario out to you, because it kind of applies to data ethics. And I've actually read about some organizations doing this, especially in the HR part of the organization. And they're starting to develop models. And these models use data like how much vacation a person takes, or how many sick days they take, or if they have children, they take, parental leave, or, how often they're on email or during the day or an evening, how effective they are. They kind of base that effectiveness off of that, or on the chat applications or so on. And they use these models to generate data like what's the risk of a person leaving the organization, or how much does it cost the organization, and whether they should give a specific amount of bonus to that person based off of that. And now it sounds like science fiction, but to me, it's on that seesaw of whether it's ethical or not to use that information. You're basing that person's abilities and whether you should give them money or so on and so forth based off of some data that sometimes might be out of their control. What should organizations be looking for? Like you said, it's really hard to get data that's not biased, and or to not use data that's not biased. But it sounds like organizations are trying to use this data to be more effective, to save money, and so on. Where's the balance? Where can organizations be, and what can they do to balance that out?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the premise for me is just like crazy, but I also recognize that that's going to be important for organizations. Like you're saying, it saves money, it saves a lot of time. It can be really valuable. Now, how can you make it fair for the employees themselves? Well, one, figuring out, fine, we're building this model. We have to recognize that there's going to be bias in our data. So when we build the model, is it actually being fairly applied? So one thing that is really common in the world of responsible, fair ML is that a model should meet a certain fairness criteria in that, like, the raise, let's say, should be given equally to people across different sort of sensitive groups, provided they have the same sort of background. So a woman with the same experience and, you know, abilities and, you know, performance ratings as her male colleague should get the same bonus. And if you build a model where for some reason the male colleague is getting 10K more, that's a big problem, right? That's a warning sign. So look for those kinds of fairness criteria within your models. That's one way to think about it. The other thing too is, again, going back to sort of that intentionality, transparency, say, okay, this is what we're doing. We're using a model to figure out what we should do in terms of your bonuses or your extra vacation days or whatever. And for you, this is what you're getting. And here's what the model did, right? Or here's why the model thinks that. And that's where you get into the explainability space. The sort of, well, based on your education or your hours worked or your tenure here, this is why the model thinks XYZ for you. And then beyond that, then the data scientists and overseers of this can continue to monitor governance and monitor sort of what if examples, like Brian mentioned earlier, around sort of, is this, if we vary one thing, right? If we just vary the gender of a person, how much does the model change? Or if we vary some other factor, what happens? And coincidentally, all of these things can be done inside of Data IQ, but I didn't say that.
Well, I'll tell you what. I want to have one last quick question. This is Chibert. I love science fiction. What do you think? Should we have a three laws of AI, just like Arthur C. Clarke's three laws of robotics? Is that just too simple, or maybe it's a good goal? What do you think?
Wow. Okay. Now you're like really tugging at my heartstrings, because part of me is like, yeah, absolutely. Right. But three laws, I don't know if that's actually going to be enough. You know, and I'm thinking about iRobot and his three laws that he figured out how to sort of get around. And I know humans, right? And I know how we can find loopholes for ourselves. So maybe it's more than three laws. And maybe it's starting from a place of understanding what it is I want to do with AI. How is it going to impact my business? How is it going to potentially harm others? And what am I okay with, right? What are my limits and what are not the limits? To an extent, I do think we're going to need some guardrails, because there are certainly going to be folks out there who say, there is no limit. I'm going to do whatever I want. But we should also be, as data scientists, as practitioners, as people in the industry, coming to terms with what it is we're okay with and what we're not okay with, so that when we see something that's a problem, we can actually be ready to act on it.
Well, Trivedi, thank you so much for being here. We're running a little bit low on time, but I did want to give you a chance to tell the folks at home where they can go to learn more about Data IQ and maybe how can they get started.
Yeah, so go to www.dataiq.com, DATAIKU, and there is a free for life license on there that you can get and download. It's a great tool. It's a great product, and our blog also has lots of content around responsible AI, MLOps, governance, lots of other fun stuff. So please be sure to check it out.
Fantastic. Well, folks, you've done it again. You sat through another hour of the Best Dang Enterprise podcast in the universe. So tune your podcaster to Twyatt. I do want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-host, starting with our very own Mr. Brian Chi. Chibert, what's going on for you in the coming week, and where can people find you?
I'm going to be doing lots and lots of cleaning and a few other things. Moving into a now empty house. I just got the keys today. But you know what? More to the point, I want to hear from you. My Twitter address is ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab. But you're more than welcome. Oh, in fact, there's a picture of my new house.
Very nice.
Anyway, the whole idea is we want to hear from you. We get some great, great show ideas. We get some great feedback. We've got some mud thrown at us from time to time, but, you know, that's all right. We want to hear from you. So I'm Chebert, Cheebert, at twit.tv. But better yet, why don't you throw it at twyatt@twit.tv, and that'll hit all the hosts. We look forward to hearing from you, and we keep those show ideas coming. Take care.
Indeed, indeed. Thanks, Chebert. Well, we also have to thank Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, so what's going on for you in the coming week? Where can people all find all of your work?
Well, as always, they can find me on Twitter. I'm at KG4GWA. I'm going to be writing some more for Dark Reading, putting some stuff on Instagram when I get a chance. I'm really interested. I'm working on some stuff in vulnerability management and enterprise security management right now. And I'm really curious to hear from people about how happy they are with the vulnerability management tools they have. Or with the enterprise security management tools they have. You know, are there things you wish you could have? Are there things you're not finding in anyone's products? Shoot me a direct message over at KG4GWA on Twitter. Would love to hear from you.
Thank you, Curtis. Thank you guys for being here. Well, we also have to thank you as well. You're the person who drops in each and every week to get your enterprise and IT news. And we want to make it easy for you to watch and listen to our show. Go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twyatt. They'll find all the amazing back episodes, the show notes, all the guest information, the co-host information, of course, all the links that we do during the show as well. But more importantly, next to those videos, you'll get those helpful subscribe and download links as well. Get your support the show by getting your audio version, your video version of your choice, and listen on any one of your devices and on any one of your podcast applications, because we're on all of them. So definitely subscribe and support the show. It's best way to stay on top of your enterprise and IT news, and it's also best way to support us as well. Now, after you subscribe, impress your friends, your family members, your coworkers with the gift of Twyatt, because we have a bunch of tech topics we talk on the show, a lot of fun stuff, and I guarantee that they will find it fun and interesting as well. So definitely share it with them and have them subscribe as well. Now, if you're already subscribed and you're available on Fridays at 1:30 p.m. Pacific, we're here live. We do lots of things live here. We do blips and bloops and all that fun stuff in the background. Come see how the pizza's made. Come see how the show is run. That can be done at live at twit.tv. So check it out live. If you're going to watch the show live, you might as well jump into the chat room live as well. We have a bunch of great characters there. Some great comments and questions. We actually direct the show by a lot of the comments and discussions we have in there. That's at irc.twit.tv. Come join the fun and the discussion during the show. But hey, don't worry about it. If you're not can't watch the show live and you can't be part of the chat room live, that's okay, because we have another great way for you to be part of the discussion 24/7 on our amazing community over at twit.community. It's a great website. We talk a lot about all the shows, the content during the shows. All the hosts are out there. There's lots of tech talks and topics that we chat about throughout the weeks. So if you want to be part of the discussion, you might as well check out that site and be part of it 24/7. Remember, you can always follow me at twitter.com/LouMM. There I post all my enterprise tidbits, a lot of what I do during my work week at Microsoft. Of course, sometimes I post a little bit of my grumblings of what I don't like and dislike about some companies out there. But that's okay, right? You can always find a little bit more about what I do at Microsoft at developers.microsoft.com/office. There we post the latest and greatest ways for you to customize your office experience and make it more productive for you and your organization. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support us each and every week, and we couldn't do this with enterprise tech without them. So thank you for all their support. Thank you to all the engineers and staff at Twit. They do great work, and we couldn't do without them. Couldn't do the show without them for sure. And I've also thank you to Mr. Brian Chi one more time, because he's not only our co-host, but he's also our tireless producer as well. He gets all the show bookings and the show notes in there. Thank you, Chibert, for all your support. We couldn't do the show without you. And before we sign out, we do have to thank our editor for today, our longtime friend. He's come back to do some editing for us, Mr. Kevin. Thank you so much, Kevin, for being back and supporting us. And of course, we have to thank our TD for today, Mr. Ant Pruitt. He's one of the busiest people there at Twit, doing tons of shows and content each and every week. Ant, what's going on for you in the coming weeks on Twit?
Well, we're still going to keep kicking out some awesome hands-on photography content, such as this week, where I got into a little bit of listener feedback and some image critiques. And I think I was gentle on them, so I wasn't too harsh on them this week, right? Go check it out, twit.tv/hop.
Thanks, Ant. And until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.
Hope you enjoyed that episode. If you would like to laugh while learning about how to take control and take advantage of all of the features that your iOS devices provide, then you should check out iOS Today. The show Rosemary Orchard, my co-host, and I, Micah Sargent, host every week on the Twit Network. It's all things Apple all the time.